God bless everybody. Good to see you all. I guess I'll just start out with how I typically like having props, just because they're fun and they help you remember things and they're amusing. My prop today is just this, a boring paperclip. That's my prop, little paperclip. And the reason I chose this as my prop, hello over there, is that a long time ago when I started out writing, an assignment I had as a young writer was to describe a paperclip to an alien, and that is, to someone who's never seen one. And I couldn't just pull out a paperclip and say, here it is. You had to use words. That was the challenge as a writer. And there were two things that I learned from this. One, it's incredibly difficult to describe a paperclip. And two, that when you are trying to explain something to someone that they have no understanding of, you try to explain it in terms of something they understand. So you try to compare it to something they do know. And I bring this up because we're going to look at figures of comparison. That's the topic, figures of comparison. And it's the way we sort of understand things. We get to the point of understanding what we don't know in turn by comparing it to things we do know. Or we start to understand something that's complex by comparing it to something that's simple. Now the first figure we're going to look at has been treated like a second-class citizen since ancient times. And I just used it, simile. And that's literally true, actually. Even though it's a simile, it's literally true. Simile's been looked down on for thousands of years. It's not even a 100th-class figure, citizen, whatever. But a simile, to give a basic definition, a modest definition might be that it's an explicit comparison, usually using like or as. So an explicit comparison, usually using like or as. There are other words you can use, or even phrases, but they're the most common ones, and the ones we'll look out for. Another thing that's important when looking at figures of comparison, there are two elements in a figure of comparison. There's the subject, which is the thing you want to learn about. And then there's the thing it's compared to, and that's usually the thing that you already know. So to give a popular example, life is like a box of chocolates. Forrest Gump. So most of us probably know that one. Now, obviously, that wasn't meant to teach Forrest about boxes of chocolate. He already knew about that. That was the simple thing. Life is the complex thing. Very hard to understand, but it was meant to help him understand something about that complex thing called life by comparing it to something simple, like a box of chocolates. But another thing, and the third thing to keep in mind as you look for similes, is that when you come across like or as, and think of them as flag words, you come across like or as, you're like, there's like or as. Not every time you come across like or as is it going to be a simile. So you have to stop a moment and say, okay, is this literal? Before you just assume it's a simile. Is this literal? If it's literal, well, then it's not a simile. If it isn't literal, then it's probably figurative, and therefore it's probably a simile. So, let's go to the first example. Let's go to Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14, and we're going to start in verse 3. And there, I'll give you a moment. In verse 3 it says, "For Herod had laid hold on John," and that's John the Baptist, "and bound him, and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. For John said unto him, It is not lawful for thee to have her. And when he would have put him to death, he feared the multitude, because they counted him as a prophet." So you have the flag word as. But if you take a moment and look at the phrase, counted him as a prophet, that was meant literally. They didn't think of him to be similar to a prophet, but not really a prophet. They really thought he was a prophet. It basically means they considered him to be a prophet, is literally what it means. So that's literal, not figurative. That's not a simile. But now we're going to look at a simile. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 28. Bless you. Proverbs 28. Bless you again. Or maybe not again. It wasn't the same person. Chapter 28, Proverbs. We're going to look at verse 1. It says, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion." Flag word, as. Is that literal?
No.
Okay. So I'm not supposed to sun myself on the plains of Africa and when I finally get hungry enough, run after an antelope and tackle it? That might be fun. Well, maybe not. I'll probably get impaled by the antelope, most likely. I don't have big claws. But, so, obviously it's not literal, so it's figurative. Well then, the question is, what's it teaching us about how a righteous person is supposed to act? What's it saying about a righteous person?
Bold.
They're bold. And how is a lion bold? The word bold there, actually, it means feel secure, safe. That's the Hebrew word and what it means. The lion feels secure and safe. Why? Because nobody's out for his hide. All the other animals are afraid of him. None of them are looking to him and going, "Oh, lunch." Right? So the righteous should feel that way when, you know, they're walking around. You know, nobody's out for them. Why? Because God has their back. You know, if you think of Psalm 27, verse 1, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" You know, that says it a little more plainly. Still figures in there, but it's a little more obvious. And that's something you'll find. A lot of times, figures of speech, like you'll find a simile or a metaphor or something like that, you can find them other places said literally. So sometimes you can see these in other places. So the righteous person is supposed to be bold, not afraid, because God is taking care of them. Let's go to Psalm 1. This is a beautiful use of simile. It's extended. Psalm 1, and we're going to start in verse 1. And it says, Psalm 1, verse 1 says, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper." So we have the flag word "like." So should I go find a river, dig a hole next to it, bury my feet? No, probably not. Actually not. So it's figurative. So the thing to do here is look at the context. The verse before that, verse 2, we're talking about the godly man, right? "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly." What does he do? He delights in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. In that context, we get a simile about this man of God. "And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water." Well, what's he meditating on? The Word. That's the rivers of living water. That's what's feeding him. Just like the river that the tree's planted near is feeding the roots of the tree, this man spiritually, he's rooted in the Word, and he's being fed by it spiritually. So he's like a tree planted in the Word, rooted in the Word. And then the simile is extended, which is wonderful. That by the river's order, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. And that remind you of Galatians, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, the fruit of the Spirit. He brings them forth because he's rooted in the Word. And his leaf shall never wither. He's like a tree that never sees autumn. His leaves are always green. It's really cool. And whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. Now we have the opposite. In verse 4, the ungodly, which he had been contrasted with in the beginning, are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. Again, flag word, like. Now, chaff are the husks of grain. After you thresh wheat or another grain, you have the husks. And the ungodly are like husks. Are they literally husks? No. No, they're like husks. And husks, actually, can be used metaphorically, if you look it up in the dictionary, as anything that's worthless. Because the worthless part of the grain is just, it can be blown away by the wind. And in this context, that's what the ungodly are like. And in contrast to the man of God, the godly person who's rooted in the Word and doesn't get blown around when the wind comes or blown about by every wind of doctrine, the ungodly is like the chaff. Let's take a look at one more before we move on to another figure, Matthew chapter 9. Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful use of a simile? Mm-hmm. See, why does simile get a bad rap? That's beautiful. It's beautiful. Here's an example of how, you know, God is a great writer. Or as Steve said before, he uses everything perfectly. And we'll see that more and more. There are figures that God uses that I don't dare touch as a writer because they just don't work for me. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'll learn. Matthew 9, and in verse 36, it says, "But when he," this is Jesus Christ, "saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them, because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd." Flag word. So he's not... Huh? As. Yeah, exactly. So, was he looking at sheep?
No.
No, he's looking at people. But he's comparing them to sheep that have no shepherd. And the shepherd keeps the flock together, makes sure it's fed, and protects it. And Jesus Christ is, in other verses, compared to the good shepherd. He feeds the people of God, protected them, took care of them. He came to accomplish things. So the people were like sheep. They were scattered abroad. They were exposed. They weren't spiritually rooted. They were scattered. They were probably prey to the adversary at this point. So he felt compassion. He was like, wow, look what we need to do here. Got to take care of these people, So, again, simile. But now we're going to move on to another figure. The next one is the king of figures. And just like before, I just used it. It's a metaphor. It is the king of figures. Metaphor actually can be used if you say, we say this is figurative language. You can actually say it's metaphorical language and mean the same thing, because metaphor is so important. At least, that's what people say. Now, a metaphor literally means transference, and it's considered to be sort of like a compressed simile. And the reason is that the explicit part of the simile is taken out. And sort of what you have left is a metaphor. So, a pedestrian example would be, the simile is, my car is like a tank, because it's explicit. So I just take out the like, and I say, my car is a tank. That's a metaphor. And you can see examples of that in the Word. In 1 Peter, it says, all flesh is as grass. But then in Isaiah, it says all flesh is grass. So you have these, so you can see how it's compressed. You just take out the explicit part and you have a metaphor. You still have that thing saying this is that. Yeats has one that says wisdom is a butterfly. Once pointed out that metaphor to a professor at college, and he said, "Wow, Yeats must have regretted that one." Yeats didn't write well when he was young. Anyway, let's take a look at some in the Word here. Let's go to Matthew chapter 26. Not far from where we were. Now this is one Steve had brought up, said that you have to be careful not to take things literally that are meant figuratively. And this is an example of one of those verses that is figurative, and people still take it literally, and it causes a lot of problems. So, Matthew 26, and in verse 26... "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to the disciples, and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body.'" Okay, now that better be figurative, right? Okay. Now, what's the idea in the figure? We know in Luke, Jesus also said, "Do this in remembrance of me." So, this was something to be done later after Jesus was no longer there. So the bread is to represent his body. "Take, eat, this is my body. This will represent my body when I'm gone, when I'm not here." So that's the metaphor. The bread is the body. The body is the subject, though. That's what we want to know about. Remember I said in a figure of comparison, you have a subject and you have the thing it's compared to. And the subject is what we want to know about. The bread isn't what we want to know about. The body of Christ is what we want to know about. That's the subject. And that's still the subject for us when we take communion, right? That's what we're trying to remember. What did he accomplish? Our healing. And that's what he's trying to say. The body is the subject. That's the important part. Let's look at the next verse. "And he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink ye all of it, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins.'" Again, better not be literal. So, it's figurative. Again, after he's gone, the subject is what he accomplished. The figures in here get a little more complicated, but we're not going to go into that. It's still metaphorical. Represents his blood, then also represents what he accomplished. Forgiveness. Forgiveness of sins. And that's what we're to remember. Something I've pointed out when we've looked at this verse, and I think it's one of those interesting things to see how precisely God picks figures. It's just to take a moment and think of these two metaphors as similes and how ridiculous that would have been. "Take, eat. This is like my body." It becomes silly. It couldn't have been a simile. It had to be a metaphor. That's how precisely the figures are chosen. It would have become ridiculous any other way. It wouldn't have made sense. Let's look at another one. Oh, this is a wonderful one. This is wonderful. Psalm 84. Now you see how there's the subject and then what it's compared to? You're following that subject, what it's compared to, and then you're learning about the subject. Let's look at this one. Psalm 84, verse 11. "For the Lord God is a sun and shield." I'm not going to go any further. is God a sun? We're sun worshippers. No. Sunbathing now is the big thing. No, probably not. So I guess we're supposed to learn something about God by this comparison. God is a sun. So what's a sun do? Well, probably the most obvious thing is it gives light. God is spiritual light. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. Spiritual light. So God is spiritual light. A shield. He's not a shield either, I guess. Either that or we don't have any. Not now. But what does a shield do? It protects you. God protects you. So God gives spiritual light. God protects. He's teaching us about what he wants us to know about himself. Bless you. So, you know, and you can, I'm sure there are verses, I'm sure that are coming to your mind as well, you know, where God says these things a little more explicitly, you know. Because I can think of a number of verses where God says he protects us. Proverbs, it says, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. You know, God protects you, not the horse. Let's go to Matthew 5. In Matthew 5, in verse 13, Jesus Christ says, "Ye are the salt of the earth." He's talking to the disciples. And what salt do? Preserves. There you go. Teaching them something about their presence, spiritually speaking. Obviously, it's not, you know, if you hold on to some meat, it's not going to go bad. It's a figure of speech. It has to do with a spiritual truth, not a truth about preserving food. Let's look at the rest of that. What was that? 13. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Verse 14. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill, and hill cannot be hid. The light of the world. Again, spiritual light. As we walk in the Word, when we show forth God's love and God's light, God is light. Ye are the light of the world. We reflect God's light. We manifest that as we renew our mind to the Word. Ye are the light of the world. Spiritual light. Just as God is the sun. No. Let's move on to the next figure. Now the next one is... it's the farthest from simile that you can go. It's called hypocatastasis. Don't have to know how to pronounce that. With a simile, it's explicit. You have like or as or something that sort of slaps you in the face and says, this is a figure. Then with metaphor, we took that explicit piece out and just said, you know, my car is a tank. With hypocatastasis, the subject of the figure, because I said we have a subject and we have the thing it's compared to, we take the subject out and just have the thing it's compared to, and it's just implied. You're just implying the metaphor, and that's what hypocatastasis is. It's an implied metaphor. So, with a simile, I said, my car is like a tank. With a metaphor, I said, my car is a tank. With hypocatastasis, I say, I drive a tank. And if I'm not in the Army, you know, if I'm in the Army, you might wonder, am I talking about my car or am I talking about my tank? But I'm not in the Army, so if I said it, you can bet it's hypocatastasis. And my car isn't a tank, actually. It's more like a Beetle. So you can see this in other figures, sort of like if someone's dealing with a difficult situation or an impossible situation. We might say they're banging their head against a wall. That's hypocatastasis, because the obstacle is implied. We never said what it was. We didn't say it was an obstacle. We just made a pretty clear image that he's having a hard time with it. And that's usually what hypocatastasis does. It makes a very clear image. Sometimes it can be a little confusing for people. We'll see that as we look at examples in the Word. Let's go to Matthew 16. Another one is he's swimming upstream. That'd be hypocatastasis. The obstacles or the difficulties he's going against are implied. He's swimming upstream. Matthew 16. You tool. Oh. That's another one. somebody, thank you. Thank you. Chapter 16, verse 5. And when his disciples were come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have taken no bread. Oh my! Uh-oh! He's mad. But, which when Jesus perceived, he said unto them, O ye of little faith, why reason ye among yourselves because ye have brought no bread? Do ye not yet understand, neither remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets ye took up? Neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets ye took up? How is it that ye do not understand that I spake it not to you concerning bread, that ye should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees? Then the light bulb went off. Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. So Jesus had to give a lesson on figures of speech. Again, just like Steve pointed out in another instance. You could be a little, you know, it was contextual, you know, they forgot the bread and he said bread and maybe they were talking about it at the time, who knows. But it's very funny, you know. Jesus had to say, you know, look, don't you remember how God took care of this? You really think I'm talking about physical problems here? He's talking about the doctrine. So he didn't say their doctrine is like leaven, and he didn't say their doctrine is leaven. He just said, beware of the leaven. And that was hypocatastasis, because he only implied the subject. And the leaven, of course, spreads throughout the entire loaf of bread. That's why just a little bit, so don't take any of it, because it'll just spread out. And that's what he was trying to warn them of. Let's look at another one. Here's another one where he was misunderstood. John chapter 2. Gospel of John chapter 2. Gospel of John, chapter 2, verse 19. It says, Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. So the hypocatastasis is right there. We're going to continue reading. The next verse says, then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body. He just finished, you know, throwing the money changers out and everything, and he's standing there at the temple. So they're thinking he's talking about the building. No, this temple. The body is a temple. He could have said the body's like a temple. Body is a temple. He didn't say that. He just said, I will destroy this temple, or raise it up in 3 days. Hypocatastasis. Had to give him another, there's another lesson in there. More figures of speech. Let's move on to another one, a new figure. The next figure is called Prosopopoeia, or simply personification. So if you don't want to hurt yourself, just say personification. It took me a while to be able to say that too, so I won't fool you. It's when you attribute human characteristics or traits to either inanimate objects or ideas. So when somebody refers to their car as a she, that's personification. Or when you see a figure outside, you know, a court, a blindfolded figure holding the scale and the sword, and that's justice, that's personification, because justice is an abstract idea. This is one of those figures that, as a writer, I try to avoid. It's just hard to use well without sounding silly. But God can do it. Genesis chapter 4. This is one of those examples where God uses a figure of speech, and to me, it just blows me away how amazingly powerful and dramatic this is. And I know if I had tried to do something like this, it'd seem like, you know, a child's fairy tale. You know, if trees talk in a child's fairy tale, or maybe in, you know, in like some fantasy story or something like that, it makes sense. But, you know, in a poem I write, this doesn't work. Genesis chapter 4, verse 10. And this is right after Cain slew Abel. And God said, and he said, that's God, "What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." Does blood have a voice? No. At this point, it's inanimate, an inanimate object. And even before it wasn't inanimate, it still didn't have a voice. Or a mouth, or a tongue, or anything like that. So it's personification. But, I mean, what personification? You know, it crieth out to me from the ground. Incredibly dramatic. I'd like to write like that. Anyway. Let's go to Proverbs. Here's a wonderful personification. Proverbs chapter 8. Now, Proverbs chapter 8 is the entire chapter is personification. Let's look at verse 12. It says, "I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions." The question is, who's talking? Wisdom. But wisdom's not a person. So it's personification. Because wisdom is an abstract thing. It's not walking around out at Manhattan, you know, going to some Broadway show somewhere. So it's personification. Let's look at the all of chapter 8 is the personification of wisdom. And most of this is wisdom speaking. Let's look at verse 22. "The Lord possessed me in the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was." Now, I think it's safe to say God is wise. Okay. That's how it's true. Wisdom was, you know, God was wise before he made all of this. So, wisdom was there before all of us and all the earth and everything else. God had wisdom, so wisdom was there. So when wisdom says, you know, "I was there before all of this," you know, not true in that sense. God is wise, but not separate from him, not a person. Let's look at the end. We'll just read the last few verses. Verse 34, "Blessed is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates. waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoso findeth me findeth life, and shall obtain favor of the Lord. But he that sinneth against me wrongeth his own soul. All they that hate me love death. It's quite dramatic having wisdom saying these things. You know, it really emphasizes and dramatizes, you know, how important wisdom is. You know, wisdom is the principal thing. That's what it says in Proverbs, the beginning of Proverbs. And, you know, what better way than to have wisdom saying, you know, if you don't love me, you love death. Either love me or you love death. That's a pretty intense statement. We're going to move on to the final figure we're going to look at. That is condescensio, which Steve mentioned. And that's when you have human characteristics or animal characteristics or traits applied to God. So, you say, like the hand of God, that's condescensio. Because God doesn't have hands. He's a spirit. Let's go to Psalm 91. This is quite a beautiful one. I particularly love this persona, this figure. Speak up. This is quite beautiful. Psalm 91. We're going to start in verse 2. Just so you know, there are a lot of figures going on in this particular psalm. Don't worry about all the others if you catch wind of them. Just going to look at the condescensio. Verse 2. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In him will I trust. Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his wing, his feathers. And under his wings thou shalt trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Does God have feathers? God's a bird. You know, fluttering around. All those images of doves. No. But he's comparing himself to birds. And you know how birds, they brood. That's what they call it. Not being sad. But they hold their wings over the nest and sort of protect and incubate, actually, the young. It's really quite beautiful looking. It's really tender looking. And that's that image that God's calling to mind. You know, we're under those wings, and God's protecting us and keeping us warm and safe. And that's the image he wants, you know, to evoke. He's taking care of us. It's all good. I got you. You know, it's a wonderful little image. And that's condescensio. Look at one more. 2 Chronicles, chapter 16, going toward the front. And in 2 Chronicles, chapter 16, we look at verse 9. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth. That would be weird if that were literal. You see these eyes whipping around everywhere. But obviously it just means God sees everything, you know, but doesn't have physical eyes. When you picture it, do you picture animal eyes or do you picture human eyes? Doesn't matter, does it? Doesn't matter. It's condescensio. God doesn't have eyes. But he sees everything. So, just to quickly summarize, we looked at figures of comparison. And you can look at those if you get the figures of speech in the Bible. Bullinger sections these out. And figures of comparison are a whole different section. And it's the way God helps us to understand things that he wants us to understand and to emphasize things. So I guess that's everything. And if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to talk up a storm afterwards. That was a figure of speech. God bless. Love you.
Michael, you did an excellent job. Thank you. I'm as happy as a clam.
Happy as a lark.
Yes. So, you know, it says in the Bible that the Lord possessed me. Did you know that? So, if I don't understand something, you know, an apparent contradiction, or if I don't understand it, it's either in my understanding or the translation. Now, I thought the devil possesses people, but I can show you a verse, and actually we just read it, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And the Bible says that the Lord possessed me, but I thought the devil possesses. But in the context, what did the Lord possess?
Wisdom.
So understanding that in the context, we see that, and that explains then in the context, and using the key of figures of speech, then we could understand that verse in its context.